Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli. And thank you, journalist and author Daniel Lazar from New York. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Yikoda Tafwa, the entire team in the capital of Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإن لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio.
This hour's headlines: Israel says it is working on how to protect hundreds of Israelis against possible war crimes probes by the International Criminal Court. The U.S. imposes sanctions on two commanders of Yemen's Ansarullah movement despite removing the group from its terrorist blacklist. Also this hour, Brazil registers an all-time record for the number of COVID-related deaths in a single day, with over 1,600 people dying from the disease. Those were the top stories. Our top story: Israel is moving to protect hundreds of its nationals, including the regime's military affairs minister, Benny Gantz, who might be subject to war crimes probes by the International Criminal Court. Gantz says Israel, which is not a member of the court, rejects the ICC's jurisdiction as working on how to protect the Israelis against possible probes. The Hague-based tribunal ruled last month that it has jurisdiction over the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the ruling could lead to criminal investigations in the area. The ICC is set to look into Israel's disproportionate use of force in the 2014 war on Gaza, its settlement activities, and the regime's deadly response to the 2018 protests by Palestinians. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the ICC's probe into Israeli crimes is a welcome move in terms of holding the regime accountable for the horrific actions that it has carried out over the years.
The Zionist entity has been dragged unwillingly into this process. It has not itself signed up to the ICC, but because the ICC recognizes Palestine, the UN system recognizes Palestine to agree, there is a modest movement of surveillance into the crimes of the Israeli army, particularly the attacks on Gaza and the home demolitions in the West Bank and so on. In an attempt to be even-handed, they've also said they are going to investigate some of the claims made by Israel against the Palestinian resistance. But it's a welcome move forward in terms of accountability and holding the Israel to account for the horrific crimes that have been carried out in recent years. The fact that there is public accountability, independent accountability, is going to be quite important in terms of the perceptions and the exposure of the apartheid system in Palestine.
Israel has approved a plan for the construction of about 1,000 new settler units in the East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The approval comes despite international calls on Israel to stop its settlement expansion projects on occupied Palestinian land, Mona Candil reports.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gad Ze'ev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma and Anata, northeast Jerusalem Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And building the settlements in there, in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just they block it either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway, a bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli-issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem Al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Dozens of Lebanese demonstrators have blocked roads in several cities to protest against the country's financial crisis. Protesters shut down a main highway out of the capital, Beirut, the airport road and streets near the city of Baalbek. They also targeted a foreign exchange bureau in the southern city of Sidon. Demonstration comes as the Lebanese currency tumbled to a new low in a financial meltdown that has fueled poverty. Latest decline in the country's pound takes Lebanon's minimum wage to about $70 a month. Political leaders in the country have failed to agree on a rescue plan since the crisis erupted in late 2019 when dollar inflows dried up. The United States has imposed sanctions on two commanders of Yemen's Ansarullah movement despite removing the group from its terrorist blacklist. According to the U.S. Treasury Department, any assets of the movement's Air Force commander Mansour al-Saadi and its naval commander Ahmed al-Ahsan al-Hamzi will be frozen. Washington accused the two of having ties with Iran and carrying out attacks threatening civilian lives. The sanctions come despite Washington's decision to remove Ansarullah from its terror blacklist in mid-February. Washington is critical of Ansarullah's ongoing offensive against Saudi-backed former regime elements in Ma'arib province and its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Riyadh launched a devastating war on its neighbor in 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of people. Yemeni journalist and political analyst Youssef Maori says the U.S. asset freeze against Ansarullah commanders is only a symbolic move to appease its ally Saudi Arabia.
These Ansarullah officials, they don't have any bank accounts somewhere in Switzerland or in the U.S. or any other nation for that matter. So they're really not going to do anything. They're more symbolic to appease Saudi Arabia. The U.S. and Western powers are making it very clear that if you are on the side of the U.S., if you are on the side of Western powers, they're going to protect you. You have immunity. You can get away with killing. You can get away with starving an entire nation. You can get away with dropping bombs on people's homes and killing their children while they are asleep. When we hear these Western officials say that Ansarullah poses a threat to the entire region, we have to read in between the lines and understand what they mean by that. And I believe that the reason why they're saying this is because they realize that if Ansarullah continues to rise to power, and if Ansarullah takes over Yemen, then the entire region is indeed going to witness a dramatic change. And if this change comes to existence in the Middle East, where there is a new regional power, then this is not going to be obviously in the interest of Saudi Arabia or Western powers. Anybody and anyone who stands against U.S. interests in the region is going to be on their enemies list. And if you're on their enemy list, as we have seen in Yemen, they will literally starve an entire nation and commit genocide in order to make sure that the current status quo remains in their interests in the Middle East.
Humanitarian organizations have warned that their aid programs in Yemen will be severely affected after a UN appeal for donations fell short of reaching its goal. The International Rescue Committee said people's lives are at stake, adding that funds are crucial for delivering life-saving assistance on a large scale. The Save the Children charity said over the past year, some 9 million people received half the rations they were granted compared to 2019. The International Organization for Migrations program in Yemen said it was only 50% funded last year. The agency said the reduction forced it to cut support to healthcare facilities serving large numbers of displaced people. Now, clashes have erupted between protesters and police in Myanmar as anti-coup demonstrations continue unabated. Security forces fired tear gas and warning shots to disperse demonstrators in the commercial capital, Yangon. Myanmar has been rocked by protests following a military coup that toppled de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi on February the 1st. Suu Kyi and most of her party's members have been in custody since then. President Win Myint was also detained. He is now facing two new charges, including a breach of the constitution. Myanmar's military seized power, alleging that November elections had been rigged. It has launched a crackdown on anti-coup protesters. At least 21 people have been killed and hundreds arrested so far. Brazil has logged over 1,600 new deaths, the country's highest single-day COVID-19 fatalities recorded so far. The latest figure put Brazil's total death toll at more than 257,000. The health ministry also reported nearly 60,000 new infections, bringing the country's total to over 10.6 million cases. Also in Latin America, Mexico announced nearly 8,000 new infections and just over 1,000 deaths. According to data from the Johns Hopkins University, the United States remains the world's worst-hit nation by the respiratory disease, with nearly 28.8 million cases and more than 516,000 fatalities. EU lawmakers accuse pharmaceutical firms of contributing to the bloc's floundering vaccination rollout. Large inoculation centers across the European Union are barely being used due to vaccine supply issues. Jerome Hughes tells us more.
Less than 10% of the EU's inhabitants have so far been given a COVID-19 vaccine. This is minuscule when compared to the progress made in the bloc's closest allies, the UK and US. Vaccine producers have been grilled in the European Parliament. AstraZeneca is accused of not fulfilling contracts it signed with the EU.
How is it possible that you had no clue of your production capacity? Because what has happened is not a minor setback, it's a huge failure.
AstraZeneca is providing 60% fewer doses to the EU in the first quarter of the year than promised.
How does AstraZeneca explain the export of vaccine produced in the EU to the UK, but at the same time the company is not willing to ship vaccine from the production site in the UK to the EU?
The firm is promising to ramp up production. It says delays happen because hundreds of ingredients are required to make the vaccine.
What is made in the EU, as I said before, overwhelmingly stays in the EU, including the site in the Netherlands that was originally reserved by the UK.
The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was developed by Germany, but the EU signed supply contracts 4 months after the UK.
EU countries such as Hungary, Austria and Denmark are availing of vaccines from China, Russia and Israel. This shows divisions are growing within the bloc as nations break away from the European Commission's vaccination strategy.
EU citizens are growing more impatient by the day as they witness the health and economic impacts of the pandemic.
If EU would be able to press more intensively on the producers or pharmaceutical companies producing the vaccines, that would be wonderful.
Of course, this is the solution. It must be quicker because, you know, within 2 months, the summer will begin.
The European Medicines Agency, or EMA, is the EU institution that approves vaccines in the bloc. Producers were asked to comment on the EMA's seemingly slow approval record.
All of the data that goes to support the application for approval in the UK is actually being shared with the EMA.
One angry lawmaker suggested the only thing not delayed are the profits being raked in by pharmaceutical giants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Standard or stranded migrants have demonstrated in Mexico City's in Mexico City of Tijuana on the U.S. border. They have called on the new U.S. administration to let them enter the country. The migrants demanded entry despite having no active cases in migrant protection protocols. That's a program launched under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It forced more than 65,000 asylum seekers back to Mexico while their cases were being heard by U.S. immigration courts. The Biden administration has reversed Trump's policy, but for now it is only processing active cases. Migrants without such cases have been waiting for months in the Mexican camps. They are mainly from Central American countries and want to enter the U.S. in search of a better life. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has stressed the importance of what he called a return to democracy in Venezuela through free and fair elections. Blinken made the comment as he spoke with Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido. The top U.S. diplomat described his country's efforts with other groups to increase pressure for power transition in Venezuela. January of 2019, Guaido declared himself president. He argued President Nicolas Maduro's re-election a year earlier was fraudulent. The U.S. and the EU threw their support behind Guaido. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on the Venezuelan government, including measures targeting the oil sector. President Maduro there says the U.S. is seeking to overthrow his government, with Guaido being a puppet of Washington. Now, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has unanimously approved William Burns to become the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Senator Mark Warner, the Democratic chair of the committee, says the veteran diplomat has, quote, unquestionable qualifications for the position. The bipartisan approval clears a path to a full Senate vote on President Joe Biden's pick to lead the CIA. Burns, who is 64 years old, is a former Deputy Secretary of State and Ambassador to Russia and Jordan. At a confirmation hearing last month, he called China's leadership the biggest geopolitical test for the U.S. Burns said gathering intelligence on China would be a priority for the CIA. Now, FBI Director Christopher Wray says the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol was an act of domestic terrorism.
That attack, that siege, was criminal behavior, plain and simple, and it's behavior that we, the FBI, view as domestic terrorism. It's got no place in our democracy, and tolerating it would make a mockery of our nation's rule of law.
Wray added that the domestic terrorism has been, quote, metastasizing across the U.S. for a long time now, and it'll not go away soon. He noted that some of those who attacked Congress were racially motivated or subscribed to far-right militia movements. The FBI chief also debunked theories that left-wing extremists, including Antifa supporters, had infiltrated the mob that attacked the Capitol. On January the 6th, supporters of former President Donald Trump raided the Capitol building in a bid to overturn the result of the November 2020 presidential election. Trump had refused to concede his loss and claimed voter fraud was the reason that he was not reelected. Defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice believes extremism and domestic terrorism are the biggest threats the U.S. is facing today.
May if we think about what the director has actually said in Washington, D.C. before Congress, it really acknowledges what we saw on January 6th, the idea that the domestic terrorism, that internal developments, the schisms inside the United States, are in many ways the biggest threat that the United States is seeing right now, and specifically some of the motivating factors behind it. I think that it's really important to acknowledge that we are where we are. So that was really something to see today. It also really highlighted exactly who they were going after. In some cases, it was sort of right versus left, but in some cases, it was just straight racism. So it really, again, highlights the schism that we're starting to see in the U.S.
A major Muslim organization in Canada has called for the immediate creation of a bipartisan committee to deal with racist and Islamophobic crimes in that country. National Council of Canadian Muslims says racism is a real problem in Canada. The advocacy group has accused authorities of turning a blind eye to the crisis. Their remarks follow a spate of recent attacks against black Muslims. Five Somali-Canadian Muslim women have been assaulted in the city of Edmonton in the past 10 weeks. Last year, more than 60 such crimes were reported in the city. That's it from You Get Yourselves.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, To thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Limelight. Researchers say sharks eat grazing animals that feed on aquatic plants like seagrass, which helps maintain water clarity, stores carbon dioxide, and houses fish and other organisms that can keep seas healthy. We now present you an article written by Howard Cohen. The piece is titled Study Finds Sharks Can Help Marine Ecosystems Survive Effects of Climate Change. The article has been taken from the BangalDailyNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Howard Cohen's article. When a major hurricane, extreme heat or other climate threat devastates an ocean's lifeblood, its recovery could be aided by the presence of sharks. Sharks as oceanic medics. That's the idea behind the study on sharks and their role in the ocean. The study, led by researchers at Florida International University, FIU, was published in the Journal of Animal Ecology. The Florida International University scientists said, "Decimate sharks and you've made oceans less resilient to extreme climate events." Researchers at the University of Washington and Deakin University in Victoria, Australia also contributed to the new research study. The study was conducted from May 2013 through to August of 2014 and funded through a combination of National Science Foundation Rapid Response Grant and fellowship awards and public donations. The team included lead author Rob Nowicki, a research affiliate at Sarasota Moat Marine Laboratory. He was joined by co-author Mike Heithouse, a marine ecologist and dean of Florida International University's College of Arts, Sciences and Education. and Florida International University seagrass expert James Forkeran. The team found that predators, like some sharks, including tiger sharks in this study, are critical for maintaining stability and biodiversity in the world's oceans. The study found sharks are important in helping ecosystems recover when devastation hits from hurricanes or marine heat waves. The researchers say sharks eat grazing animals that feed on aquatic plants like seagrass, which helps maintain water clarity, stores carbon dioxide, and houses fish and other organisms that can keep the seas healthy. To reach its conclusion, the team conducted a 16-month study in Shark Bay, Australia, an area populated by tiger sharks and dugongs, a cousin of the Florida manatee. Dugongs are strictly marine animals, whereas manatees can thrive in freshwater areas. The study said grazing animals, including turtles and dugongs, eat seagrass. Sharks eat the grazers. Grazers fear the sharks, so when sharks are around, the grazers often avoid the area. While the grazers are away, the aquatic plants have time to grow and recover. When an extreme climate event strikes, the ecosystem must deal with a whole new set of variables that require time to recover. Shark Bay was selected because a historic heat wave had decimated much of the bay's seagrass canopy in 2011. Researchers found recovery was slow, but was aided by the seasonal presence of sharks. The grazers feed on shallow seagrass meadows, but swim to deeper waters until sharks leave in winter. But the 2011 heat wave destroyed much of the shallow seagrass canopy, and the dugongs munched much of what was left. Researchers wanted to know what would happen if the sharks didn't return during the summer months and the dugongs had free rein to eat up the grass. In April and May 2013, the team placed 30 experimental plots, 2 to 3 meters deep, in two seagrass banks in Shark Bay. Florida International University reported by using previous calculations of how many dugongs were around and how much they ate, researchers were able to mimic the way dugongs feed on the seagrass in the summer months and what it would be like if there was no sharks around. Florida International University said in a news release, their experiment left the area with no recovery time, meaning if the dugongs grazed year-round, they'd end up inadvertently destroying the critically important seagrass canopy. The research shows that when top predators are gone, not only does the structure of the ecosystem break down, but it's also all but impossible for the ecosystem to stage a comeback. The lead author of the new research, Nowicki, said in a statement, "One of the reasons we did this study is because we think it's important to be thinking about how everything is linked, and sometimes those linkages are surprising," he added. But they show climate resilience is not something that happens on its own. It happens in conjunction with species conservation. Co-author of the report, Heithaus, added, "Every ecosystem on the planet depends on a delicate balance of relationships. The findings fulfill one of the study's goals to keep the links linked, meaning conserving predators and prey." Nowicki said, "Ultimately, to rein in climatic extremes that are becoming more common and intense, we know we need to cut carbon dioxide emissions and carbon production, but that's going to take time," adding, "It's almost like we're on a leaky boat with a hole. We need to fix the boat at some point, but in the meantime, we can grab a bucket and get the water out. That's kind of what we're doing here. We're making the case that protecting predator species and keeping these species' relationships can actually lead to resilience to these events. It can buy us time, and we need as much time as we can get.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, my name is Amir Taylor from British Capital. Now we kick things off as there are disappointing news about the aid intervention for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, as Saeed Poureza reports.
A chilling warning at the end of Monday's virtual UN pledging conference, participated by more than 100 governments and donors. Of the nearly $4 billion sought by the world body, only $1.7 billion was offered. Among the countries cutting aid to the war-ravaged nation, the United Kingdom, a country that's benefited immensely from the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, who are using them against the Yemenis.
This is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And for any country to slash its aid to Yemen by 50% at this time is a really disgusting act.
By the UN's account, more than 16 billion Yemenis, about half the population, will face hunger this year. Nearly 50,000 are already starving to death in famine-like conditions.
The dying has started because the aid operation is half of what it should have been and because the war is continuing.
It's a war that's been raging for 6 years now, a Saudi-led military campaign that's received support mainly from the US, the UK, and France. And it all began in 2015, aimed at reinstating this man, Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, as president after he lost the capital Sana'a and other strategic territories to the Houthi fighters. What the Saudis thought would be a quick military intervention has turned into a protracted conflict that's killed and injured tens of thousands. In 2019, a UN report said Britain, the US, and France might be complicit in war crimes in Yemen by arming and providing support to the Saudi-led coalition. All three have also provided Yemen with aid.
Britain will stand by Saudi Arabia through thick and thin because of that close economic relationship between the Saudis and the UK. So I don't expect Britain to break that relationship. And I think it's hypocritical, of course, that they are involved in this war on Yemen and at the same time are trying to morally assuage themselves by donating UK aid to that country.
By all accounts, Yemen is on the brink. And with this dramatic reduction in international aid by donor countries such as the United Kingdom, that man-made disaster is bound to take a turn for the worst. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Well, Brett Yonkers, who's the editor-in-chief of Hadad Yemen News Agency, joins us from Belgium. Hi, good to have you on the bulletin. We saw there that UN Chief Antonio Guterres called this disappointing, the way in which the international community has stepped up or failed to do so. Your reaction?
It is definitely a very disappointing development, but unfortunately, I don't think that it could be considered surprising. And even if, let's say, the amount of aid that was given to Yemen, for Yemen was met, the $3.7 billion U.S. dollars that were called for by the United Nations, even then, of course, this is just barely, you know, scraping by in order to try to save these people. I think Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, one of the main figures within the National Salvation Government of Yemen, which is called, of course, the Houthis, in a lot of media nowadays, he voiced his concern very, very well. He said, you know, the only real aid that Yemen needs is quite simple, the end of the war and the end of the blockade. All of this UN aid and the aid that is given by either the West, by Saudi Arabia, and even by well-meaning countries that are neutral in this conflict, all of this aid is the bare minimum that is necessary in order to somewhat lighten the load that Yemen is carrying, somewhat lighten the misery that Yemen has been carrying, the crimes that have been inflicted on this country ever since 2015. And the fact that even this bare minimum cannot be done by the nations of the so-called civilized world, of the so-called democratic free world of the West, and not by a big organization, of course, a world-renowned organization such as the United Nations, which is created with the express goal of preventing human rights abuses and preventing war worldwide, the fact that this bare minimum has failed to be achieved is absolutely saddening. But unfortunately, for anyone who has really been following Yemen for years, and especially since this war started in 2015, this is not a surprising act. Yemen has always been silenced. The situation in Yemen has very often not been reported upon by mainstream media and the West especially. They have always tried to hush what was going on in this nation. And even now that it is sort of gaining traction in mainstream consciousness, there is very little being done in terms of deeds to really back off the words that are being spoken. And this is the latest shameful act in a very, very long story of suffering and abuses for Yemen, unfortunately.
Indeed, and very briefly, Brett, you know, it's been a terrible year for Riyadh. We're just hearing this week about the U.S. intelligence and the kingdom's crown prince and the situation with Jamal Khashoggi. And then we're hearing of the millions of Yemenis who are starving due to this Saudi-led war. In the middle here is Saudi Arabia, yet nothing seems to be happening in regards to holding them accountable for any of this.
Yeah, this is definitely what is the biggest case of hypocrisy I think we have seen in a long time. We know for a fact now, and everyone kind of knew that, but even the U.S. has admitted now that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is directly responsible for the torture and brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But much more than that, much more important than that, and much more destructive than that, has, of course, been his almost genocidal war against Yemen. And this also is something that has been reported on over and over again, that we know is going on, that we know is happening, 60 million people in direct threat of starvation, and yet, at the end of the day, in the West, especially in the UK, in the US, and in France, the what carries the day in the end, what matters in the end, is the money. And the one country that is willing to give billions, of course, in funding, in oil money, let's say, to buy this modern equipment, modern war equipment from the West, is Saudi Arabia. And so far, this has always been carrying the day. This has always won in the end, the argument of money. And as long as the people in the West don't, you know, wake up and start doing something again to hold their governments accountable for this, right, and really force them to come to terms with, you know, the will of the people, then I'm afraid this will continue.
Profit over people, as always. Thank you so very much.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now we have some worrying news, or it could be worrying news for Labour Party leader Sir Keir Starmer. But before we get into that, Ahmed, social media has been going in on this Yemen story. Just bring it up to date for us, please.
Yeah, I mean, some people are calling out the hypocrisy because, okay, the UK has halved its aid budget to Yemen. So now it's 87 million when it previously pledged 164 million. But what people are calling out the hypocrisy over is that the UK is the second largest arms dealer to Saudi Arabia behind the United States. So we have this bizarre situation where the UK was providing aid in a situation in which it was partly responsible. Now, to give an analogy, that would be like there being a fire and somebody showing up with a small cup of water but with a barrel of gasoline. Now, that is what was happening with the UK in regards to aid, while continuing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia in contradiction to the UK's own ruling, in which it found that the arms sales to Saudi Arabia were illegal because they were used on civilian infrastructure to target schools, hospitals, funerals, and people doing everyday grocery shopping. Now, the UK has reputed that and disputed that claim and said that no, okay, Saudi Arabia does commit war crimes, but these are isolated incidents. Now, Human Rights Watch disagrees with this and says no, there's not isolated incidents, and has submitted a 172-page submission to the UK last year indicating the exact opposite. But, and time shows, when it comes to profit, it always trumps morality and on this case, international law. So there has been a fierce reaction online with Chris Williamson, who is the former Labour MP. He says Gulf cuts aid to Yemen yet continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. That is responsible for the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Now, the UN has said that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Currently, there are 20 million people, two-thirds of Yemeni population, who depend on humanitarian assistance. But they wouldn't depend on humanitarian assistance if the war wasn't supported by the UK, France, and the US. And Bernadette says, condemnation for the UK's inexplicable cut to Yemen aid. UK companies profit from the war by selling the bombs, UK military trains the pilots, and then, when the Yemeni people are desperate, UK government cuts the aid. Shameful.
All right, so somebody might be using the term shameful for another situation that's been ongoing inside the Labour Party, but I won't ruin it for you. Bring us the story, Ahmed.
Yes, so lawyers demand Labour explain hiring of Israeli spy. So a leading human rights lawyer firm representing a British Palestinian Labour member are demanding answers for the party's hiring of former Israeli spy, and they want to know why a Israeli spy or ex-Israeli spy who was part of the infamous Unit 8200 was hired, not only hired, but hired to monitor the social media usage of Labour members, and are rightfully concerned that this could be used or handed over to Israeli regime forces and agencies. And there could be detrimental consequences for British Palestinian members of the Labour Party and potentially their family back home in Palestine. So as you can imagine, there's been a fierce reaction online. Simon says, shocking, Israeli intelligence officer employed by UK Labour to spy on members' social media accounts. Legitimate criticism of Israeli regime apartheid policies, colonisation, ethnic cleansing, racist medical rationing will become impossible. Jack Hughes raises a very important point. He says, why are they calling him a former Israeli spy? Has he had an epiphany? And I think this is an important point, because if you understand what a spy is, The point of a spy is to infiltrate potentially an organization and to work on behalf of another entity. So is he an ex-spy or is he actually a spy still? Was he working for the Labour Party or was he still working on behalf of the Israeli regime? These are questions that will rage on and people will continue to ask and wonder why there hasn't been a response from Sir Keir Starmer or others within the Labour leadership about this action.
All right, that's an excellent question to leave things on, Ahmed Kabbella. Thank you very much. Now, to some other news, because the Pentagon has announced $125 million in military aid for the Ukraine to help in its long-running conflict with Russia. During the White House press conference, Washington stated that the aid would include training, equipment, and advisory efforts, and quote, to help Ukraine's forces preserve the country's territories. Russia and Ukraine relations deteriorated back in 2014 when the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea rejoined Russia following a landslide referendum which voted in favor of the unification. The two sides then launched into a bloody conflict in eastern Ukraine, which has so far claimed some 13,000 lives. Russia has previously accused Western nations, such as the U.S., of interfering in its domestic and geopolitical pursuits. Now, opponents and supporters of the embattled Armenian Prime Minister, well, they've held rival rallies in the capital, Yerevan. Thousands of opposition supporters demanded the Prime Minister resign, while others marched to his residence in support. Nikol Pashinyan has faced demands to step down since he signed a peace deal in November that ended 6 weeks of intense fighting with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. As a result, Azerbaijan reclaimed control over large parts of the embattled region, with some question marks over the army's loyalty.
The army must do its job. The army cannot look back. The army cannot participate in political processes. The army must obey only the people and the political power chosen by the people. Anyone who acts outside this logic, acts against the people, acts against statehood, against the rule of law, and acts against the security of the Armenian Republic.
The uneasy truce between Azerbaijan and Armenia seems to be holding, with pleas from regional powers to maintain the peace. Now, Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Grenfell, says U.S. President Joe Biden's administration plans on engaging with Iran and repairing its past alliances.
We are looking for opportunities to encourage the Iranians to go back to compliance. And if they make that decision, we are prepared to also rejoin the JCPOA.
Just 1 week after the U.S. and European signatories of the JCPOA met to discuss ways in which they could revive the historic 2018 deal. Tehran, however, has since stated that it would go back to full compliance of the deal once Washington has lifted all of its unilateral sanctions. In some other news now, Saudi Arabia's envoy to the UN says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is not responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and the US and Saudi Arabia should just move on. In 2018, the Washington Post columnist was hacked to death inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul whilst his fiancée waited for him outside. A recently declassified US intelligence assessment concludes the Saudi Crown Prince personally approved the operation. Calls for Washington to act on the information are growing louder, but the White House has admitted it does not typically sanction countries it has diplomatic relations with, despite slapping visa restrictions on dozens associated with the murder. Richard Sedan, one of these days, you and I are going to discuss some items in social media that will leave us with a pep in our step and joy in our hearts. But today is not that day, sir. Let's begin with some disturbing news from down under.
Yes, and good to be with you again, Amina. This is a shocking headline for our first story. Neo-Nazi leader arrested after assaulting a black security guard at Channel 9. I just want to reference a recent statement by the United Nations Secretary General, who said white supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are a global transnational threat requiring global solutions. With this in mind, the incident which took place in Melbourne, Australia.
An assault captured on film there, Richard.
Exactly, and the black security guard was racially abused at the same time. Thomas Sowell, the self-styled leader of the National Socialists, has now been arrested. What's interesting is actually Thomas Sowell said he, and I quote, fears no investigation, and yet the incident we just saw took place outside Channel 9 precisely because Channel 9 were about to run an investigative report on him and his movement. And I think, you know, and many people agree really and are making this observation, that incidents like these are a stark reminder that anywhere where settler colonialism took place, white supremacy is rearing its head, and increasingly it's being viewed as a very vile, virulent form of extremism. And of course, you know, we're seeing examples of this surface globally, and people are really demanding that the political class take action, and that the media and, of course, politicians really diagnose this kind of white supremacy as it should be, according to how many people see this, Amina.
Now I'd like you to go into the social media there with a few last comments when we come back.
So let's go first to Richard Edwards, who says, given that Victoria Police officers are known for using excessive force, I hope that vile neo-Nazi Thomas Sowell, when caught by police, resists arrest. Held accountable chimes in with, do you know who Thomas Sowell the Australian is? Let me tell you, he is a neo-Nazi trying to organise terror groups. As a conservative living in the USA, you should understand there is no place in society for people like this. Take care.
It's to show this man in his element. He's a literal Nazi, and I think a nasty Nazi wouldn't have been out of order for me to say. Now we move on to another story, Richard, which has some parallels, if you don't mind me saying, but it's on the other side of the ocean. Explain.
This is an interesting one. White nationalists once again are using Christian symbols to spread hate. So there's a number of media outlets picked up on this, Amina. And what's happening is we've seen or are seeing Christian symbolism used increasingly during far-right white nationalist, white supremacist rallies and meetings, whatever you really want to call them. And actually, this was visible none more so than during the January the 6th riots, which took place in Washington, D.C. And this is a very poignant throwback, really, to, of course, the famous symbolism we're all used to seeing, which is, of course, the symbolism of the Ku Klux Klan, most notably in the United States. And I think what many people are saying, this is very dangerous, because when you have extremism ideology with people who really believe they're doing the bidding of God, this makes for a very lethal cocktail, of which we've seen the ramifications of in the past. And I think people are worried now we're essentially going to see some of these ramifications possibly in the present. So again, this is another harsh reminder. We're seeing this kind of ideology, this extremism spreading everywhere. And actually, January the 6th was a very pertinent example of that, Amina.
So how are we able to make a clear distinction as to an extreme minority fringe who are misusing and misappropriating a sacred symbol here, when, dare I say it, other religions don't escape as freely?
That's a very important point and question indeed, Amina. And I think one thing we should say here, of course, is that there are millions of Christians, millions of people of all faiths all around the world that are actually fighting against racism in all of its forms. But there's no getting away from this. This kind of symbolism has a massive presence in the US, certainly amongst, for example, the Proud Boys and also the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, and many other groups. And so I think, you know, we've seen this, we're probably going to see more of it. And I think many people would agree, and many people are certainly saying, it makes for the worst kind of apologism, really, regarding this kind of extremism, which we're seeing surface time and time again, Amina.
All right, let's rattle through some of that reaction.
Let's go to Jay Garner first, who says, evangelicals are the American version of the Taliban. I would not want to be in any heaven that would have them. They twist and shape God to be who they want him to be. Andy Hawkins says, white nationalists are once again using Christian symbols to spread hate. Makes complete sense. Why the surprise? We have a reaction from Andrew Netter Williams, who says the white people in power in America don't want to admit it exists. That's why they haven't been given the same attention, because they are white. And we have a reaction from Mad Dogs, who says the only hate being spread is the liberal media and left extremist Democratic Party. I don't know any conservative that spreads hate, but I do know many liberals who do. Just a reminder, Amina, there's a plethora of reactions and different views online talking about this story.
All right. All right, we leave it there, Richard Sedan, and we leave you here for the moment. In any case, stay safe.
In the limelight.
Under U.S. law, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, as he is widely known, ought to be banned from travel to the United States and subjected to an asset freeze. That President Biden has chosen not to pursue that course suggests that the fundamental change he promised in U.S.-Saudi relations will not include holding to account its reckless ruler, who consequently is unlikely to be deterred from further criminal behavior. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Quilly Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "This Will Embolden the Murderous Prince: Biden Rebuked for Letting MBS Off Hook for Butchering of Khashoggi." Here's more.